Chapter 9. A Signal. Nynaeve had to admit that Tom and Julian between them had chosen a good campsite, in a sparse thicket growing on an eastern slope, covered with dead leaves, a scant mile from Mardison. Scattered sour gums and some sort of small, droopy-branched willow screened the wagon from the road and the town, and a 2-foot-wide rivulet ran from a stone outcrop near the top of the rise, down a bed of dried mud twice as broad. Enough water for their purposes. It was even a little cooler under the trees, with a small and welcome breeze. Once the two men had watered the team and hobbled them where the horses could feed on the sparse grass upslope, they tossed a coin to decide which should take the lanky gelding into Mardison to purchase what they needed. The coin flipping was a ritual that they had developed. Tom, whose nimble fingers were used to performing sleight of hand, never lost when he flipped the coin, so Julian always did it now. Tom won anyway, and while he was stripping the saddle from Skulker, Nynaeve put her head under the wagon seat and levered up a floorboard with her belt knife. Besides 2 small gilded coffers containing Amathera's presents of jewelry, several leather purses bulging with coin lay in the recess. The Panarch had been more than generous in her desire to see their backs. The other things looked trifling by comparison. A small dark wooden box, polished but plain and uncarved, and a wash leather purse lying flat and showing the impression of a disc inside. The box held the 2 Turangrial they had recovered from the Black Adja, both linked to dreams, and the purse, that was their prize from Tanchico, one of the seals on the Dark One's prison. As much as she wanted to find out where Swan Sanche wanted them to chase the Black Adja next, the seal was the source of her haste to reach Tar Valon. Digging coins from one of the fat purses, she avoided touching the flat purse. The longer it remained in her possession, the more she wanted to hand it to the Amarlin and be done with it. Sometimes she thought she could feel the Dark One trying to break through when she was near the thing. She saw Tom off with a pocketful of silver and a strong admonition to search out some fruit and green vegetables. Either man was likely as not to buy nothing but meat and beans, left to himself. Tom's limp as he led the horse off toward the road made her grimace. An old injury, and nothing to be done for it now, so Moiraine said. That rankled as much as the limp itself. Nothing to be done. When she had left the 2 rivers, it had been to protect young people from her village, snatched away in the night by an Aes Sedai. She had gone to the tower still with the hope that she could somehow shelter them, and the added ambition of bringing down Moiraine for what she had done. The world had changed since then. Or maybe she only saw the world differently. No, it is not me that's changed. I'm the same. It is everything else that's different. Now it was all she could do to protect herself. Rand was what he was, and no turning back. And Egwene eagerly went her own way, not letting anyone or anything hold her back, even if her way led over a cliff. And Matt had learned to think of nothing but women, carousing, and gambling. She even found herself sympathizing with Moiraine sometimes, to her disgust. At least Perrin had gone back home, or so she had heard through Egwene, second-hand from Rand. Perhaps Perrin was safe. Hunting the Black Adja was good and right and satisfying, and also terrifying, though she tried to hide that part. She was a grown woman, not a girl who needed to hide in her mother's apron. Yet that was not the main reason she was willing to keep on bashing her head against a wall, keep on trying to learn to use the power, when most of the time she could not channel any more than Tom. That reason was the talent, called healing. As wisdom of Emmons Field, it had been gratifying to bring the women's circle around to her way of thinking, especially since most were old enough to be her mother. With not many years on Elaine, she had been the youngest wisdom ever in the 2 rivers. And even more so to see that the village council did what they should, stubborn men that they were. The most satisfaction, though, had always come from finding the right combination of herbs to cure an illness, to heal with the one power. She had done it, fumbling, curing what her other skills never could. The joy of it was enough to bring tears. One day she meant to heal Tom and watch him dance. One day she would even heal that wound in Rand's side. Surely there was nothing that could not be healed, not if the woman wielding the power was determined enough. When she turned from watching Tom go, she found that Elaine had filled the bucket that normally hung beneath the wagon and was kneeling to wash her hands and face, a towel around her shoulders to keep her dress dry. That was something she particularly wanted to do herself. In this heat it was pleasant sometimes to wash in water cool from a stream. Often enough there had been no water but what was in the barrels strapped to the wagon, and that was needed for drinking and cooking more than washing. Julin was sitting with his back against one of the wagon wheels, his thumb-thick staff of pale ridged wood leaning next to him. His head was down, that silly hat tipped precariously over his eyes, but she was not willing to bet on even a man sleeping at this time of the morning. There were things he and Tom did not know, things it was best they did not know. The thick carpet of dead sour gum leaves crackled as she seated herself near Elaine. "Do you think Tan Chico really has fallen?" Rubbing a soapy cloth slowly across her face, the other woman did not reply. She tried again. "I think that white cloak's Aes Sedai were us." "Perhaps." Elaine's voice was cool, a pronouncement from the throne. Her eyes were blue ice. She did not look at Nynaeve. "And perhaps reports of what we did got tangled with other rumors. Tarabon could have a new king and a new panarch very easily." Nynaeve kept her temper in check and her hands away from her braid. They clutched her knees instead. "You are trying to put her at ease with you. Watch your tongue." "Amethera was difficult, but I do not wish her any harm. Do you?" "A pretty woman," Julin said, "especially in one of those Tara Bonner serving girl's dresses, with a pretty smile. I thought she..." He saw Elaine and her looking at him, and quickly pulled his hat back down, pretending to sleep again. She and Elaine shared a glance, and she knew the other's thought was the same as hers. Men. "Whatever has happened to Amethera, Nynaeve, she is behind us now." Elaine sounded more normal. Her washcloth slowed. "I wish her well, but mainly I hope the Black Aja is not behind us. Not following, I mean." Julin stirred uneasily without raising his head. He was still uncomfortable with the knowledge that Black Aes Sedai were real and not simply a tale in the streets. "He should be happy he doesn't have our knowledge." Nynaeve had to admit that the thought was not entirely logical, but if he had known about the Forsaken being loose, even Rand's foolish instruction to look after her and Elaine would not have kept him from running. Still, he was useful at times, he and Tom both. It had been Moiraine who had fastened Tom to them, and the man knew a great deal about the world for an ordinary gleeman. "If they were following, they'd have caught up by now." That was surely true, considering the usual lumbering speed of the wagon. "With any luck, they still do not know who we are." Elaine nodded, grim but her old self again, and began rinsing her face. She could be almost as determined as a Two Rivers woman. "Leandrin and most of her cronies surely escaped from Tan Chico, maybe all of them. And we still don't know who is giving orders for the Black Aja in the tower. As Rand would say, we still have it to do, Nynaeve." Despite herself, Nynaeve winced. True, they had a list of 11 names, but once they were back in the tower, almost any Aes Sedai they spoke to might be Black Aja, or any women they encountered on the road. For that matter, anyone they met might be a dark friend, but that was hardly the same thing, not by a wide degree. "More than the Black Aja," Elaine continued. "I worry about Mo..." Nynaeve put a quick hand on her arm and nodded slightly toward Julin. Elaine coughed and went on as though that was what had stopped her. "About Mother. She has no reason to like you, Nynaeve. Quite the opposite." "She's far away from here." Nynaeve was glad her voice was steady. They were not talking about Elaine's mother, but the Forsaken she had defeated. Part of her hoped fervently that Mogadine was far away. Very far. But if she was not? She is, Nynaeve said firmly, but she still hitched her shoulders uncomfortably. A part of her remembered humiliations suffered at Mogadine's hands, and desired nothing more than to face the woman again, to defeat her again, for good this time. Only, what if Mogadine took her by surprise, came at her when she was not angry enough to channel? The same was true of any of the Forsaken, of course, or of any Black Sister for that matter. But after her rout in Tanchico, Mogadine had reason to hate her personally. Not pleasant at all to think that one of the Forsaken knew your name and likely wanted your head. That is just rank cowardice, she told herself sharply. You are not a coward, and you will not be. That did not stop the itch between her shoulder blades every time Mogadine came to mind, as if the woman was staring at her back. I suppose looking over my shoulder for bandits has made me nervous, Elaine said casually, patting her face with the towel. Why, sometimes when I dream of late, I have the feeling that someone is watching me. Nynaeve gave a start at what seemed an echo of her own thoughts, but then she realized there had been a slight emphasis on dream. Not any dreams, but Tel-Iron Riod, another thing the men did not know about. She had had the same sensation, but then there was often a feel of unseen eyes in the world of dreams. It could be uncomfortable, but they had discussed the sensation before. She made her voice light. Well, your mother is not in our dreams, Elaine, or she would probably snatch us both up by an ear. Mogadine would probably torture them until they begged for death, or arrange a circle of 13 Black Sisters and 13 Murdral. They could turn you to the shadow against your will that way, bind you to the Dark One. Maybe Mogadine could even do it by herself. Don't be ridiculous, woman. If she could have, she would have. You beat her, remember? I do hope not, the other woman replied soberly. Do you mean to give me a chance to wash? Nynaeve asked irritably. Putting the girl at ease was all very well, but she could do with less talk of Mogadine. The Forsaken had to be somewhere distant. She would not have let them come this far peacefully if she knew where they were. Light send that that's true. Elaine emptied and refilled the bucket herself. She was a very nice girl, usually, when she remembered that she was not in the royal palace in Camelin, and when she was not acting the fool. That Nynaeve would take care of when Tom came back. Once Nynaeve had enjoyed a slow, cooling wash of face and hands, she set about making the camp ready, and put Julin to breaking dead branches from the trees for a fire. By the time Tom returned with two wicker hampers slung across the gelding's back, her and Elaine's blankets were laid out under the wagon, and the two men's under the hanging branches of one of the 20-foot willows. A good supply of firewood had been stacked. The tea kettle stood cooling beside the ashes of a fire in a circle cleared of leaves, and the thick pottery cups had been washed. Julin was grumbling to himself as he caught water in the tiny stream to refill the water barrels. From the snatches Nynaeve heard, she was glad he kept most of it to an inaudible mutter. From her perch on one of the wagon shafts, Elaine hardly tried to hide her interested attempt to make out what he was saying. Both she and Nynaeve had put on clean dresses on the other side of the wagon, switching colors as it happened. After fastening hobbles between the gelding's forelegs, Tom lifted the heavy hampers down easily and began unpacking them.
Mar Deason's not as prosperous as it looks from a distance.
He set a net bag of small apples on the ground and another of some dark green leafy vegetable.
With no trade into Tarabon, the town is withering.
The rest seemed to be all sacks of dried beans and turnips, plus pepper-cured beef and salt-cured hams, and a gray pottery bottle sealed with wax that Nynaeve was sure held brandy. Both men had complained of not having a bit of something with their pipes of an evening.
You can hardly take 6 steps without seeing a white cloak or two. The garrison is about 50 men or so, with barracks over the hill from the town on the far side of the bridge. It was considerably larger, but it seems Padrone Niall is pulling white cloaks from everywhere into Amador. Knuckling his long mustaches, he looked thoughtful for a moment. I cannot see what he is up to. Tom was not a man who liked that. Usually a few hours in a place was enough for him to begin ferreting out the currents between noble and merchant houses, the alliances and schemes and counterplots that made up the so-called game of houses. The rumors are all about Niall trying to stop a war between Ilion and Altara, or maybe Ilion and Mirandi. No reason there for him to be gathering in soldiers. I'll tell you one thing, though. Whatever that lieutenant said, it is a king's tax that buys the food being sent into Tarabon, and the people are not happy with it. Not to feed Taraboners. King Aelron and the Lord Captain Commander are not our concern, Nynaeve said, studying what he had brought. 3 salted hams. We will pass through Amadicia as quickly and unobtrusively as we can. Perhaps Elaine and I will have more luck finding vegetables than you did. Would you care for a walk, Elaine? Elaine got up immediately, smoothing her gray skirts and lifting her hat from the wagon. That would be very nice, after that wagon seat. It might be different if Tom and Julin let me take a turn riding Skulker more often. For once she did not give the old glee man a coquettish look, which was something. Tom and Julin exchanged glances, and the tyrant thief-catcher pulled a coin from his coat pocket, but Nynaeve gave him no chance to flip it. We will be quite all right by ourselves. We could hardly expect trouble of any sort with so many white cloaks to keep order. Planting her hat on her head, she tied the scarf under her chin and gave them a firm look. Besides, all those things Tom bought need to be put away. Both men nodded, slowly, reluctantly, but they did it. Sometimes they took their roles as supposed protectors entirely too seriously. She and Elaine had reached the empty road and were walking down the verge, on the thin grass, so as not to kick up dust, before she had it settled in her mind how to bring up what she wanted to say. Before she could speak, though, Elaine said, "You obviously want to talk to me alone, Nynaeve. Is it about Mogadine?" Nynaeve blinked and looked at the other woman sideways. It was well to remember that Elaine was no fool. She'd only been acting like one. Nynaeve resolved to keep a tight hold on her temper. This was going to be difficult enough without letting it dissolve into a shouting match. "Not that, Elaine." The girl thought they should add Mogadine to their hunt. She could not seem to realize the difference between one of the Forsaken and, say, Leandrin or Chesmal. "I thought we should discuss how you've been behaving toward Tom." "I do not know what you mean," Elaine said, staring straight ahead toward the town, but sudden spots of color in her cheeks gave her the lie. "Not only is he old enough to be your father twice over, but he is not my father," Elaine snapped. "My father was Tarangale de Modred, a prince of Cairhien and first prince of the Sword of Andor." Straightening her hat needlessly, she went on in a milder tone, though not by much. "I am sorry, Nynaeve. I did not mean to shout." "Temper," Nynaeve reminded herself. "I thought you were in love with Rand," she said, making her voice gentle. It was not easy. "The messages you have me give to Egwene for him certainly say so. I expect you tell her the same." The color in the other woman's face heightened. "I do love him, but he is very far away, Nynaeve. In the waste, surrounded by 1,000 maidens of the spear who jump to do his bidding. I cannot see him or speak to him or touch him." She was whispering by the end. "You can't think he'll turn to a maiden," Nynaeve said incredulously. "He is a man, but he isn't as fickle as that. And besides, one of them would put a spear in him if he looked at her crossways, even if he is this Dawn whatever. Anyway, Egwene says Avienda is keeping an eye on him for you."
"I know, but I should have made sure that he knew I love him."
Elaine's voice was determined and worried.
"I should have told him so."
Nynaeve had hardly looked at a man before Lan, at least not seriously, but she had seen and learned much as wisdom. From her observations, there was no quicker way to send a man running for his life, unless he said it first.
"I think Min had a viewing," Elaine went on, "about me and about Rand. She always used to joke about having to share him, but I think it wasn't a joke, and she could not bring herself to say what it really was."
"That is ridiculous." It certainly was, though, in Tyr, Avienda had told her of a vile Aiel custom.
"You share land with Moiraine," a small voice whispered.
"That isn't the same thing at all," she told it briskly.
"Are you certain Min had one of her visions?"
"Yes. I wasn't at first, but the more I think on it, the more sure I become. She joked about it too often to mean anything else."
"Well, whatever Min had seen, Rand was no Aiel. Oh, his blood might be Aiel, as the wise ones claimed, but he had grown up in the Two Rivers, and she would not stand by and let him take up wicked Aiel ways. She doubted very much that Elaine would either."
"Is that why you've been,"
she would not say, "throwing yourself at,
teasing Tom?"
Elaine gave her a sidelong glance, the crimson back in her cheeks.
"There are 1,000 leagues between us, Nynaeve. Do you think Rand is refraining from looking at other women?
A man is a man, on a throne or in a pigsty." She had a stock of homely sayings from her childhood nurse, a clear-headed woman named Lini, whom Nynaeve wished she would meet one day.
"Well, I don't see why you have to flirt just because you think Rand might."
She refrained from bringing up Tom's age again.
"Lan is old enough to be your father," that small voice murmured.
"I love Lan. If I can only reason out how to get him free of Moiraine, that is not the matter at hand."
"Tom is a man with secrets, Elaine. Remember that Moiraine sent him with us. Whatever he is no simple country gleeman."
"He was a great man,"
Elaine said softly.
"He could have been greater, except for love."
With that, Nynaeve's temper snapped. She rounded on the other woman, seizing her by the shoulders. "The man doesn't know whether to turn you over his knee or climb a tree."
"I know," Elaine gave a frustrated sigh, "but I do not know what else to do."
Nynaeve ground her teeth in the effort not to shake her until her skull rattled. "If your mother heard of this, she'd send Lini to haul you back to the nursery."
"I am not a child any longer, Nynaeve."
Elaine's voice was strained, and now the flush in her cheeks was not embarrassment.
"I am as much a woman as my mother is."
Nynaeve stalked on toward Mardison, gripping her braid so hard that her knuckles hurt. After a few strides, Elaine caught up.
"Are we really going to buy vegetables?"
Her face was composed, her tone light.
"Did you see what Tom brought back?"
Nynaeve said tightly. Elaine shuddered elaborately.
3 hams, and that awful peppered beef. Do men ever eat anything but meat if it isn't set before them?"
Nynaeve's temper faded as they walked on, talking about the foibles of the weaker sex, men, of course, and such simple matters as that. Not completely away, of course. She liked Elaine and enjoyed her company. At times it seemed as if the girl really was Egwene's sister, as they sometimes called each other, when Elaine was not acting the twitch skirt. Tom could put a stop to it, of course, but the old fool indulged Elaine like a fond father with his favorite daughter, even when he did not know whether to say boo or faint. One way or another, she meant to get to the bottom of it. Not for Rand's sake, but because Elaine was better than this. It was as if she had contracted a strange fever. Nynaeve intended to cure it. Granite slabs paved the streets of Mardison, worn by generations of feet and wagon wheels, and the buildings were all brick or stone. A number of them were empty, though, both shops and houses, sometimes with the front door standing open, so Nynaeve could see the bare interior. She saw 3 blacksmith's shops, 2 abandoned, and in the third the smith was half-heartedly rubbing his tools with oil, and the forges were cold. One slate-roofed inn, with men sitting morosely on benches out front, had a number of broken windows, and at another the adjoining stable had its doors half off the hinges, and a dusty coach squatting in the stable-yard, one forlorn hen nesting on the driver's high seat. Somebody in that one was playing the bittern. Heron on the Wing, it sounded like, but the tune was dispirited. The door of a third inn was barred by two splintery planks nailed across it. People thronged the streets, but they moved lethargically, weighted down by the heat. Dull faces said they had no real reason to stir at all beyond habit. Many women, in large, deep bonnets that almost hid their faces, had on dresses worn at the hem, and more than one man had a frayed collar or cuffs on his knee-length coat. There were indeed white cloaks scattered through the streets, if not so many as Tom had made out, still enough. Nynaeve's breath caught every time she saw a man in a pristine cloak and shining armor look at her. She knew she had not worked with the power nearly long enough to take on Aes Sedai agelessness, but those men might well try to kill her, a Tarvalan witch, and outlawed in Amadicia, if they even suspected a connection to the White Tower. They strode through the crowds, seemingly oblivious of the apparent poverty around them. People moved out of their way respectfully, receiving perhaps a nod, if that, and often a sternly pious, "Walk in the light." Ignoring the children of the light as best she could, she set herself to finding fresh vegetables, but by the time the sun reached its peak, a blazing ball of gold that burned through the thin clouds, she and Elaine had wandered both sides of the low bridge, and between them had managed to garner one small bunch of honey peas, some tiny radishes, a few hard pears, and a basket to carry them in. Perhaps Tom really had looked. This time of year the barrows and stalls should have been full of the summer's produce, but most of what they saw was heaped potatoes and turnips that had known better days. Thinking of all those empty farms approaching the town, Nynaeve wondered how these people were going to make it through the winter. She walked on. Hanging upside down beside the door of a thatch-roofed seamstress's shop was a bunch of what looked almost like broomweed, with tiny yellow flowers, the stalks wrapped their whole length in a white ribbon, then tied with a dangling yellow one. It might have been some woman's feeble attempt at a festive decoration in the midst of hard times, but she was sure it was not. Stopping beside an empty shop with a carving knife incised on the sign still hanging over the door, she pretended to search for a stone in her shoe while furtively studying the seamstress's shop. The door was open, and colorful bolts of cloth stood in the small paned windows, but no one went in or out.
"Can you not find it, Nynaeve? Take off your shoe."
Nynaeve's head jerked. She'd almost forgotten that Elaine was there. No one else was paying any attention to them, and no one looked close enough to overhear. She still lowered her voice. "That bunch of broomweed by that shop door. It is a yellow Aja signal, an emergency signal from one of the yellow's eyes and ears." She did not have to tell Elaine not to stare. The girl's eyes barely moved toward the shop.
"Are you certain?" she asked quietly. "And how do you know?"
"Of course I am certain. It's exact. The hanging bit of yellow ribbon is even split in three." She paused to take a deep breath. Unless she was completely mistaken, that insignificant fistful of weeds held a dire meaning. If she was wrong, she was making a fool of herself, and she did hate to do that. "I spent a good deal of time talking with yellows in the tower. Healing was the main purpose of the yellows. They did not care much for her herbs, but you did not need herbs when you could heal with the power. One of them told me. She did not think it too great a transgression, since she was sure I'll choose yellow. Besides, it has not been used in nearly 300 years. Elaine, only a few women in each Aja actually know who the Aja's eyes and ears are,
but a bunch of yellow flowers tied and hung like that tells any yellow sister that here one is, and with a message urgent enough to risk uncovering herself. How are we going to find out what it is? Nynaeve liked that. Not, what are we going to do? The girl had backbone. Follow my lead, she said, gripping the basket tighter as she straightened. She hoped she remembered everything Shimmerin had told her. She hoped Shimmerin had told her everything. The plump yellow could be fluttery for an Aes Sedai. The interior of the shop was not large, and every scrap of wall was taken up by shelves holding bolts of silk or finely woven wool, spools of piping and binding, and ribbons and lace of every width and description. Dressmakers' dummies stood about the floor wearing garments ranging from half-made to complete, from something suitable for a dance in embroidered green wool to a pearly grey silk gown that could have done very well at court. At first glance, the shop had a look of prosperity and activity, but Nynaeve's sharp eye caught a hint of dust in one high neck of frothy solind lace, and on a large black velvet bow at the waist of another gown. There were two dark-haired women in the shop, one young and thin and trying to wipe her nose surreptitiously with the back of her hand, held a bolt of pale red silk, clutched anxiously to her bosom. Her hair was a mass of long curls to her shoulders, in the Amadisian fashion, but it seemed a tangle beside the other woman's neat array. The other, handsome and in her middle years, was assuredly the seamstress, as proclaimed by the large bristling pincushion fastened to her wrist. Her dress was of a good green wool, well cut and well made to show her skill, but only lightly worked with white flowers around the high neck, so as not to overshadow her patrons. When Nynaeve and Elaine walked in, both women gaped, as if none had entered in a year. The seamstress recovered first, regarding them with careful dignity as she made a slight curtsy. "May I serve you? I am Rhonda Macura. My shop is yours." "I want a dress embroidered with yellow roses on the bodice," Nynaeve told her. "But no thorns, mind," she added with a laugh. "I don't heal very fast." What she said did not matter, so long as she included yellow and heal in it. Now, if only that bunch of flowers was not happenstance. If that was the case, she would have to find some reason not to buy a dress with roses, and a way to keep Elaine from recounting the whole miserable experience to Tom and Julian. Mistress Macura stared at her for a moment with dark eyes, then turned to the thin girl, pushing her toward the back of the shop. "Go on to the kitchen, Lucy, and make a pot of tea for these good ladies. From the blue canister. The water's hot, thank the light. Go on, girl. Put that down and stop gawking. Quickly, quickly. The blue canister, mind. My best tea," she said, turning back to Nynaeve as the girl vanished through a door at the rear. "I live over the shop, you see, and my kitchen is in the back." She was smoothing her skirts nervously, thumb and forefinger of her right hand forming a circle, for the great serpent ring. There would be no need for an excuse about the dress, it seemed. Nynaeve repeated the sign, and after a moment Elaine did too. "I am Nynaeve, and this is Elaine. We saw your signal." The woman fluttered as if she might fly away. "The signal? Ah, yes, of course." "Well," Nynaeve said, "what is the urgent message?" "We should not talk about that out here. Mistress Nynaeve. Anyone might walk in." Nynaeve doubted that. "I will tell you over a nice cup of tea. My best tea, did I say?" Nynaeve exchanged looks with Elaine. If Mistress Macura was this reluctant to speak her news, it must be appalling indeed. "If we may just step into the back," Elaine said, "no one will hear but us." Her regal tone made the seamstress stare. For a moment, Nynaeve thought it might cut through her nervousness, but the next instant the fool woman was babbling again. "The tea will be ready in a moment. The water's already hot. We used to get Tarabonner tea through here. That is why I am here, I suppose. Not the tea, of course. All the trade that used to be, and all the news that came both ways with the wagons, you are mainly interested in outbreaks of disease or a new kind of illness, but I find that interesting myself. I dabble a little with—" She coughed and rushed on. If she smoothed her dress any harder, she would wear a hole in it. "Some about the children, of course, but you are not much interested in them, really."
"The kitchen, Mistress Makura," Nynaeve said firmly as soon as the other woman paused for breath. If the woman's news made her this afraid, Nynaeve would brook no more delay in hearing it. The door at the back opened enough to admit Lucy's anxious head.
"It's ready, mistress," she announced breathlessly.
"This way, Mistress Nynaeve," the seamstress said, still rubbing the front of her dress. "Mistress Elaine." A short hallway led past narrow stairs to a snug, beam-ceilinged kitchen with a steaming kettle sitting on the hearth and tall cupboards everywhere. Copper pots hung between the back door and a window that looked out into a small yard with a high wooden fence. The small table in the middle of the floor held a brilliant yellow teapot, a green honey jar, 3 mismatched cups in as many colors, and a squat blue pottery canister with the lid beside it. Mistress Makura snatched the canister, lidded it, and hastily put it into a cupboard that held more in 2 dozen shades and hues.
"Sit, please," she said, filling the cups. "Please."
Nynaeve took a ladder-back chair next to Elaine, and the seamstress set cups in front of them, flitting to one of the cupboards for pewter spoons.
"The message?" Nynaeve said as the woman sat down across from them.
Mistress Makura was too nervous to touch her own teacup, so Nynaeve stirred a little honey into hers and took a sip. It was hot, but had a cool, minty aftertaste. Hot tea might settle the woman's nerves, if she could be made to drink.
"A pleasant taste," Elaine murmured over the edge of her cup. "What sort of tea is it?"
"Good girl," Nynaeve thought. But the seamstress's hands only fluttered beside her cup.
"A Tarabonner tea, from near the Shadow Coast."
Sighing, Nynaeve took another swallow to settle her own stomach.
"The message," she said insistently. "You did not hang that signal to invite us for tea. What is your urgent news?"
"Ah, yes." Mistress Makura licked her lips, eyed them both, then said slowly,
"It came near a month ago, with orders that any sister passing through heard it at all costs." She wet her lips again. "All sisters are welcome to return to the White Tower. The tower must be whole and strong."
Nynaeve waited for the rest, but the other woman fell silent.
"This was the dire message?"
She looked at Elaine, but the heat seemed to be catching up to the girl. Drooping in her chair, she was staring at her hands on the table.
"Is that all of it?"
Nynaeve demanded, and surprised herself by yawning. The heat must be reaching her, too. The seamstress only watched her intently.
"I said," Nynaeve began, but suddenly her head felt too heavy for her neck.
Elaine had slumped onto the table, she realized, eyes closed and arms hanging limply. Nynaeve stared at the cup in her hands with horror.
"What did you give us?"
she said thickly. That minty taste was still there, but her tongue felt swollen.
"Tell me."
Letting the cup fall, she levered herself up against the table, knees wobbling.
"The light burn you. What?"
Mistress Makura scraped back her chair and stepped out of reach, but her earlier nervousness was now a look of quiet satisfaction. Blackness rolled in on Nynaeve. The last thing she heard was the seamstress's voice.
"Catch her, Lucy!"